طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. At this time of year, one wants to wish everyone a Happy New Year. But it will not be a Happy New Year for Palestinians. That was guaranteed when the most right-wing Israeli government in history, and that's saying something, was elected and has come into power. There is genuine depression in Palestine because they know that however bad it has been for them in the past, it is now going to be much worse. Under this Israeli administration, that is guaranteed. And we see it already as the killing of Palestinians and punitive house demolitions have blatantly increased in the new year under this right-wing, racist, apartheid government. And the United States not only condones Israel's militarized occupation of Palestine, it is a major funder of it. So this week, we will take a look at the U.S.-Israeli relationship, current policies, and what we might expect in the future from the Biden and Netanyahu administrations. This Week in Palestine presents a forum sponsored by Brooklyn for Peace, held a few weeks ago in New York City, which featured Palestinian activists Sandra Tamira and Beth Miller, Action Director at Jewish Voice for Peace. The forum begins with introductions by Michaela, the executive director of the anti-war organization Brooklyn for Peace.
So I'm very excited to introduce our speakers for this evening's event to discuss the impact of current U.S. policy toward Palestine and Israel, and how grassroots organizers can effectively advocate for policies that promote peace, justice, and human rights. And in particular, what opportunities do we have and what challenges do we face in this new Congress and within our current political landscape in the U.S., as well as what's happening on the ground in Palestine. Sandra Tamari is a Palestinian organizer and the executive director of Adala Justice Project. She is a co-founder of the St. Louis Palestine Solidarity Committee and was co-chair of the steering committee for the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights from 2015 to 2018. Based in St. Louis, the murder of Mike Brown in Ferguson in August 2014 greatly impacted Sandra's work. And since then, she has focused on building joint liberation efforts between Palestinians and Black communities. She was a lead organizer of the Palestinian contingent to Ferguson in October 2014. Beth Miller is the political director at Jewish Voice for Peace Action, where she spearheads the group's congressional advocacy and political work. She joined JVP staff after being a longtime member leader in the JVP New York City chapter. Beth formerly worked as the U.S. Advocacy Officer for Defense for Children International Palestine, where she was a co-leader of the National No Way to Treat a Child campaign. She has a master's degree in human rights law from SOAS University of London. And so I will now hand it off to Sandra to take it away.
Thanks, Michaela, and hi, everybody. Good evening. Hope you've had a good day, and I'm really happy to be here with you and happy to be on this panel with my dear friend and comrade, Beth Miller. I kind of want to ground us into like thinking about how grassroots organizing in Palestine has transformed over the last, say, 10 years or so. The last 10 years have really been marked by a reemergence of transnational solidarity. back in the 60s, of course, the Palestine struggle was grounded in an anti-colonial struggle. Our leadership, the Palestinian leadership, was very much grounded in looking to other groups around the globe that were struggling against colonial powers. And Israel, you know, came into being at a time when many, you know, empires were falling and colonies were ending. But today we're seeing a reemergence of transnational solidarity. And it's really marked by, a reemergence of Black power, a reemergence of the Black Lives Matter movement. And really, it, as, you know, Michaela read in my bio, the moment Ferguson uprisings really were a moment of transformation in the movement. This latest phase has seen, you know, coalitions of Black, Indigenous, Palestinian, immigrant, and queer communities coming together to construct really powerful and vibrant coalitions in organizing spaces that are born out of, you know, what I feel, and I think many of our partners feel, is really a deep love for one another and a shared understanding of the forces that are holding us back. So, you know, in 2014, when Palestinians in Ferguson began forging ties with Black communities in anger over the murder of our young people, over state-sanctioned violence, it reawakened this Black Palestinian solidarity and our kinship. You know, what have we been able to do with these coalitions? I want to talk about a recent experience I had in forging ties with Indian Collective. Indian Collective is a leading indigenous rights organization. They're newer to the scene, but we have relationships with a lot of the leadership team there. We came together with them to confront the Sierra Club. As you know, Sierra Club is one of the largest environmental organizations in the U.S. Estimates are that they have 3 million dues-paying members. Some of you may be members of Sierra Club. But we learned that Sierra Club was leading tours to Israel, tours that, you know, did not acknowledge the settler colonial nature of the land they were visiting, of the Israeli regime, tours that were visiting sites in the West Bank and in the Golan Heights that referred to all of these areas as parts of Israel, and did not even acknowledge, did not even mention the existence of Palestinians. When we learned of these trips, Indian Collective and Adala Justice Project, the organization I run, along with our friends at Jewish Voice for Peace, with Movement for Black Lives, and other Palestinian advocacy organizations joined forces to confront Sierra Club and demand that they cancel these trips. We had an initial victory in that the Sierra Club did cancel the trips for 36 hours. And then put them back on. As we continue to confront Sierra Club, we're so angry that they want to continue these trips. They have a trip planned for March of 2023. They've managed to make these trips even worse than they were before. They are partnering with the Rava Institute, which is an Israeli organization that is funded and supported by the Jewish National Fund, the organization that is actively, not only historically, but actively displacing Palestinians and stealing Palestinian land. The reality is that many in our movement, I just want to give the lesson that I learned from this campaign. The lesson that I learned from this campaign is that while many of us, you know, were introduced to the Sierra Club and were introduced to their harm through Palestine, I and many in our movement did not understand the long history of racism that the Sierra Club brought to the table. That we were being introduced to the idea that, you know, the idea that our national parks are the same idea as a land without a people. That somehow you can create this pristine nature, you can you know, say that, you know, this land is untouchable, but you're denying the existence of the indigenous people that belong to that land. So greenwashing, I just want to say greenwashing, which is this act of covering up the crimes of settler colonialism through environmental activism, through this idea that somehow, you know, the settler regime is the caretaker of the land. Greenwashing is not limited to Israel. You know, it's, you know, we have it right here on this land, here on Turtle Island. And so we had to take a step back and we had to say, how are we going to ethically go forward with canceling these trips? And the only way to do that was to hold Sierra Club accountable for its 120-year, you know, long history. There's no reforming a group like the Sierra Club. And I say all of this because I want to talk, you know, about, you know, the way that we think about coalition building. It's not just a quick pronunciation of our solidarity. It's not a quick pronunciation of the parallels, that we have to dig deeper. And that, you know, that's what I think our movement is doing. And I say all of this because I want us all to be doing better, right, in our analysis of what's at stake. And I don't say this to be harsh. I really say this very humbly because I've made these mistakes. And I think that we need to be centering the demands of indigenous communities here on this land when we talk about Palestine, because we all contribute, right? We contribute not only as taxpayers, not only as people who, you know, are part of this, you know, terrible U.S. empire, this terrible U.S. military machine, but also simply by being here. If we're not indigenous to this land, we contribute to the settler colony. And I want us to understand that we don't want to, like, the same way we don't want Palestine to be the exception to the rule, we don't want to exceptionalize Israel. Israel is not an exception. Israel is very much a part of the world order, unfortunately. Very much a part of the legacy of the U.S. or the continuing settler colonial enterprise of the U.S., of Canada, of Australia, and so many other places. And so just to think about how we can dig deeper. So I think that, you know, we have a petition you can sign to really push forward, you know, the idea that the Sierra Club must cancel these trips, that really ties these all these ideas together. And so I hope that, you know, in the chat, you'll be able to get a hold of that petition, or afterwards that you can sign it. And I'm happy to take questions about that. And I want to mention just another campaign where we worked on, where we brought the power of these, you know, cross movement coalitions. As many of you know, Ben and Jerry's is a company that has taken a very bold step of pulling out of doing business in the Israeli settlements. We're thrilled. This is such an important BDS win because it sets an example for what a company can do with its name. Ben & Jerry's has always been a leader in, you know, using its brand to promote human rights and to promote social justice. And so when Ben & Jerry's finally pulled out, we all were like, wow, this opens a door. This opens a huge door for holding Israel accountable and for showing that a company can still thrive, right? While taking a really important stance. How did we get to this moment? Why did Ben & Jerry's pull out? There was a long history of, like, you know, over 10 years of work in Vermont with Palestine Solidarity activists pushing the company. But the breaking point happened when Ben & Jerry's really wanted to support the movement for Black Lives in their work to defund the police. They said, you know, they came to Movement for Black Lives and says, we want to fund this. We want to help you. We want to amplify your work. And Movement for Black Lives said, that's interesting. Our Palestinian partners are, you know, not exactly happy with you. So we're not ready to do that. So let's have a conversation about what the terms of that partnership could look like. So Movement for Black Lives made it very clear that no partnership was going to be, you know, on the table unless the demands of the Palestinian people were met, which was a complete withdrawal of their business in Israel. They pulled out. The partnership went forward. Ben and Jerry's is doing the right thing on defunding police, and they did pull out of the Israeli settlements. What we have today is the parent company, Unilever, trying to, you know, do backdoor deals to continue to market, the Ben and Jerry's brand in Israel. But technically, Ben and Jerry's and Unilever are out of Israel. There's no business that's happening here. There is a lawsuit that's happening where Unilever has now sold the license to an Israeli manufacturer, Israeli licensee. But Ben and Jerry's is in court to challenge that that decision. I feel strongly that we've won this battle, regardless of the outcome of this case. But all to say that this shows the power of, you know, bringing our partners to the table. The Movement for Black Lives and Indian Collective have name recognition, have more power than the Palestine movement. We are very happy to bring that power to the table, but we also are very conscious of, like, we don't do this because it's only about Palestine. We do this because we believe it's truly part of our mission, that Palestine is not going to be liberated in isolation, that we have to be, you know, centering our Black and Indigenous partners when we talk about Palestine. And that this is how we win. I really feel strongly these are the ways that we win. And I hope that in your communities and in your organizing, you can be thinking about how to message on Palestine, how to be advocates for Palestine in a way that lifts up all of these issues. And I know that it's not always easy, but there are times when some issues will take the forefront. And I think that it's always our job to try to find the hypocrisies, right? To find the ways that politicians, that corporations, that individuals in power are not meeting the mark. Meeting the mark meaning, you know, being consistent in their principles and being consistent in how they apply those principles across issues. I think the last thing I'll say is that the issue in the on the ground in Palestine, things are terrible. And I just hope that we can amp up and be bolder and stronger and develop these campaigns that are really going to try to turn the tides. I don't know that we're at a place, I mean, Beth will speak to this now, we're at a place where we can end U.S. funding. We aren't even at a place where we can condition U.S. funding to Israel. But I do believe we've turned the tide in the narrative, at least on the left. And I'm hoping we can move that narrative closer to the center, closer to the mainstream, and then have impact with strong organizing and strong coalition building to change policy. And I'll leave it at that, and I look forward to your questions.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Sandra. And I'll pass it now to Beth before we get into Q&A.
Thanks, Michaela. Thank you so much, Sandra, for that. That was really, it's grounding to hear examples of those kinds of cross movement relationships and campaigns. And it's like, you know, it can sometimes feel so, the idea of like building across movements and making a difference can feel so amorphous. And so to get those examples, I think is really something important for us to hold on to. And so thank you, Michaela, for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be able to speak with you all tonight and to get to speak alongside a dear partner, Sandra. My name's Beth, and I'm the political director with Jewish Voice for Peace Action. I'm going to kind of going off of what Sandra said, which is this kind of this orientation to the grassroots, right? Like, we all know that's really where the change happens, is when we build together, is when we demand change together. I'm going to kind of turn a bit and say, okay, so then how can that influence Congress? And what is the effect that what Congress and our government does have in return? And kind of where are we at in our, the way that the US government is orienting toward Israel, orienting toward Palestine, and how can we be changing it? So, you know, the first thing that I think it can be useful for us to consider is just to really reckon with the impact that our current US policies toward Palestine and toward the Israeli government have. What is the actual impact that their policies have? The impact of our US policies is massive, and it is quite terrifying, actually. The people who are most directly impacted by US policy toward Israel, toward Palestine, are Palestinians. And the impact that our policies have is that the Israeli government can more efficiently and with greater impunity kill and oppress Palestinians. So that's the impact of US policy in the region, in the area. The US government has traditionally, has for years and years and years, and continues to now, fund and kind of run diplomatic interference for Israel's systematic violations of Palestinian rights, for Israeli apartheid, for ethnic cleansing, and for any other crime that we might see committed under this Israeli government. The US's response is more often than not to either defend it or at best say that they are concerned by it. What we don't ever see is a US government response that actually takes an action to hold the Israeli government accountable for something. And so the result is that the US has funded and created and continues to support a government actor that knows that it can act with essentially total impunity, an apartheid state that knows that it can act with impunity. And in fact, the US often goes up against other countries in the international arena when other countries might call for accountability. The US is at the UN saying, no, 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 don't do that. You can't do that. That's our kind of norm. And that's not just under this administration. That's the norm for many, for years and years from the US government. If we even just look at the Biden administration this year, even just since the spring, you can really see the pattern of this, and you can see the impacts that it has and how it continues to get worse and worse. So if we, for example, start in May of 2022, when the Israeli military shot and killed Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh while she was reporting and wearing a press vest, the response from the United States government, from the Biden administration, was essentially nothing. There were dozens and dozens, unprecedented numbers of members of Congress who were calling for an investigation, a US investigation, or an independent investigation, because this was a US citizen who was killed. The Biden administration said and did nothing. And they said and did nothing when her funeral was attacked. They said and did nothing when her family called on the Biden administration to meet with them. President Biden refused to. The family eventually got to meet with Secretary of State Blinken, who essentially promised them nothing, and nothing has moved from it. Tomorrow is the 6-month marker from when Shireen Abu Akleh was killed. She's a US citizen. And her government, the Biden administration, has taken no action to hold the Israeli government accountable or to even investigate what happened. Instead, in July, President Biden flew to Israel and shook hands with the government leaders of Israel, shook hands with Lapid, shook hands with Bennett, and basically tried to help form deeper relationships between Israel and its other Arab country neighbors. That was the response. Then in August, the Israeli government led a deadly assault on Gaza and on Palestinians in Gaza, killing dozens and dozens of people, including children. And the Biden administration barely blinked an eye and did nothing. Then the Israeli government, in a pre-dawn raid, shut the doors of Palestinian human rights organizations, raided their offices, in some instances stole client files and left a big sign on their door saying, "You're closed," and welded the doors shut. the Biden administration said and did nothing. And now, over the last several months, we are seeing the ways in which this violence is boiling over. And we all know on this call that the violence is an everyday reality for Palestinians living under Israeli apartheid. It is also true that that reality can turn up. And that's what's happening right now. And the Biden administration can't muster more than saying that it is concerned by the escalation of violence and that all parties should de-escalate. When there are nightly military raids by the Israeli government and Palestinians are having the deadliest year at the hands of Israeli forces since 2014. So this is what happens. The Israeli military does something, the Biden administration says nothing. The Israeli military does something even worse, the U.S. government does not respond. The Israeli military does something even worse, the U.S. government fails to respond. When there's no accountability, when there's no tangible, concrete accountability, there is no logical reason to expect that there would be a change in action by the Israeli government. And so that's the situation that we've been in for years. That's the situation that in many ways we are still in today. And that's a sobering and upsetting reality. And it should be sobering and upsetting. It's the truth. We have to be able to reckon with, you know, where we're kind of at. What's also true is that we are at a radically different moment in popular opinion in the U.S. about what our government is doing. And what Sandra said could not be more true. We are at a tipping point moment. We are at a moment when progressive organizations, progressive Democrats, in particular, and even some more liberal, more centrist Democrats are questioning this long-held belief and logic that the U.S. government should basically just support Israel no matter what. Because that's essentially what our policy is, right? At the end of the day, U.S. policy to Israel is like, you can kind of just do whatever you want, and we're not going to take real action against you. It's hard to actually think about what a red line for the Biden administration would be. Like, what line could Israel cross that the Biden administration would be like, okay, that's it, we're doing something? I struggle to imagine what it would be. For example, they just reelected a corrupt leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, who is now in the process of forming what is likely to be the most extremist, far-right, Jewish supremacist, racist, homophobic, fascist government that Israel's ever had. The Biden administration congratulated them on their historic voter turnout. There's rumors that internally there are tensions and that the Biden administration will try not to work with certain members of the coalition, but that kind of doesn't matter, right? The public line is, we are your friend no matter what. We have shared values that transcend the government that runs you, which is an absurd thing to say. This is a nation state. It's not a friend, right? The government that runs the state is actually quite important. The policies the state upholds are quite important and should impact how we act in return. But while all that's happening, while the Biden administration is continuing this kind of stalwart, unwavering, unquestioning support for the Israeli government, no matter what it does, there's a lot happening underneath him. And that's where the opportunity is. That's where the change is. And that's because of the grassroots. That's because there has been organizing, Palestinian-led organizing in this country for decades that's been going on. And we're seeing this moment where the progressives in this country, which are gaining power, the broader progressive left in this country is mobilizing and moving and trying to push back and gain power and trying to reckon for power right now. That movement is starting to slowly but surely starting to embrace the Palestinian rights agenda as part of the broader progressive agenda, right? You're fighting for Medicare and better funding for education in schools. You're fighting to relieve student debt. You're fighting to defund the police. You're fighting for human rights for all people, no exceptions. That includes Palestine, right? This idea that if you have progressive values, you have to apply them equally. There cannot be exceptions. This idea that progressive except for Palestine is not really a thing. You can't have an except for. That is growing, and poll after poll after poll is showing that especially among Democratic voters, there is an increasing desire to see the U.S. government take harsher, stronger actions to hold the Israeli government accountable, including conditioning funding, including sanctions, and supporting other tactics that are similar to that to hold the Israeli government accountable. And the result of that has meant that we have been able to also get more progressive representatives in Congress. And so as we look toward the new Congress, as we look toward the 118th Congress, which will start in January, it's going to be fascinating. This is a weird time. I know, I'm sure everyone's feeling it. We probably should have acknowledged it at the beginning of the call. We are a couple days out from an incredibly difficult midterm election day where at once it wasn't as bad as we feared it would be, while still we are barely clinging on against anti-democratic forces, racist forces, just horrifying people who are in office and running for office and probably going to stay in office. And at the same time, organizing worked, people showed up. It's just a weird moment. Also, it's true that progressives did really well on Tuesday, and we will have more progressives in office come January. And so for us, that's a really good thing, because for us, the narrative is, and the truth is, that if you are a progressive, that must include supporting Palestinian human rights, just as it should include supporting human rights for anyone else, anywhere around the globe. And I think that we can actually look to the last Congress for a bit of hope and a bit of direction about what we can expect and what we will be advocating for moving forward in the next year, in the next Congress. So, you know, just to say, I do want to say that, you know, I just kind of spent the first part of my talk bumming everyone out with how bad the Biden administration has been. But there is a growing number of progressives in Congress who are taking historic action on Palestine. And it's kind of two things are true at once. On the one hand, that number is way too small. The number of members of Congress who will take action on Palestine is way too small because of how bad the situation is on the ground in Palestine. It doesn't meet the urgency of what's actually happening in Palestine. What's also true is that the US government is going to be the last thing to change, not the first. And so every bit of growth helps. This takes time, and we are building strategically for the long haul. And so every new progressive, every new vote, every new bill, we are building power, and that builds faster every time. And that's kind of how we create change. And so just in the last Congress, we saw Betty McCollum's Palestinian Children and Families Act, which sought to ensure that not a single US dollar could fund the Israeli military detention of Palestinian children, the demolition of Palestinian homes, or the annexation of Palestinian land. And we got 32 co-sponsors on that bill, which is more than we'd had on the previous version of that bill. We also saw a historic initiative led by Representatives Ocasio-Cortez, Mark Pocan, and Rashida Tlaib to block a Boeing weapons sale to the Israeli government in the midst of an Israeli military assault on Gaza. To give you a sense of what would normally happen in DC during an Israeli military assault on Gaza, while that was moving, there were Democrats on the floor of the House, one after another, just talking about how much they loved Israel while Israel was bombing Gaza. And Democrats and Republicans were just getting up and being like, we love Israel. We defend Israel. Israel has the right to defend itself. And then you had a small but mighty crew of progressives who got onto a bill saying there's no way we should send them more bombs right now. Look at what they're doing with these bombs. And they also took to the House floor, and they talked about the other side of things. They talked about Palestinians in Gaza. They talked about what was happening for children in buildings that were being bombed in the middle of the night. And that was historic. That was not something we'd seen before. We also have now in Congress something called the Justice for Shireen Act, which is led by Representative Andre Carson, and is a bill that demands a U.S.-led investigation into the killing of Shireen, including whether or not U.S. weapons were used to kill her. All of these things, none of them have passed. None of them have even come for a vote. But they're all pieces of legislation that would not have existed in Congress 7 years ago, 6 years ago, right? They have grown, they have escalated over time, and there is a growing wedge in the Democratic Party around this issue. And that's a really good, important thing for us, because it used to be that anti-Palestinian groups, Israel, could claim that this was a bipartisan issue and that everyone in DC loved Israel. And now that's breaking, that's cracking, because the grassroots is shifting, because American popular opinion is shifting. there is a crack in that. And we have more and more members of Congress who are saying, wait, if it's my job to control the purse strings of this government's budget, I actually have an issue with the fact that we're sending $3.8 billion every single year, and we don't even put a single condition on it. Like, are you telling me that I'm not allowed to say that I just want to make sure my constituents' taxpayer dollars aren't funding the siege of millions of Palestinians in the world's largest open air prison? Like, I can't, you're going to push me back against me on that? You're going to push back against me when I say that my constituents' tax dollars shouldn't be funding the demolition of someone's home? They're upset by that idea, as well they should be. And they're upset by it because their constituents are upset by it. And their constituents are upset by it because of the grassroots organizing and education and growing understanding that's been going on for years and years and years. And so, you know, the result of all that is that we have bigger coalitions on the advocacy sides of things too. Of the bills that I just mentioned, there are a lot of groups that endorse those bills that are newer to support for this kind of issue. And so, for example, different versions of the bill were endorsed by different groups, but some of the groups that have endorsed some of these bills include Oxfam, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Move On, Working Families Party, Justice Dems, Sunrise Movement, obviously the Movement for Black Lives and Indian Collective, which Sandra already mentioned, are really in the struggle with the Palestinian rights movement. But that kind of thing, right? When we can go to a lawmaker and say, hey, this bill is endorsed by 140 civil society organizations, some of which don't even work on Palestine, but want you to do this, that is power we didn't have a few years ago. And it's power we definitely didn't have a few years before that. And that's how we kind of keep growing and keep pushing. And I think that the truth is, I'll wrap by kind of saying, we very literally don't know what the next Congress is going to look like, right? We still don't know who's going to control Congress even. So this talk is perhaps even premature. We don't know who's going to be in control of the next Congress. But whoever's in control, there are going to be some new challenges for us. One of them is that Israel actually played an incredibly big role in this election cycle. And unfortunately, it didn't play a big role in the way it should have. It didn't play a big role because Israel was treating Palestinians with escalated violence and horrifying force. And so we were talking about it. It played a bigger role because anti-Palestinian groups like AIPAC were spending millions and millions and millions of dollars to try to keep progressives out of office. That kind of thing is both a threat and it's an opportunity for organizers, right? It's a threat because that has a real chilling effect, right? A candidate sees that and they're like, I don't want to talk about Palestine if AIPAC's going to drop $4 million against me. But it's also an opportunity because that's AIPAC, that's Democratic Majority for Israel, that's these anti-Palestinian groups showing their true colors, right? Showing that they are actually kind of anti-democratic at their core. Groups that support apartheid in Israel, they don't really care that much about democracy. They don't really care about human rights. And so it's an organizing opportunity for us because there's more people who are looking at them like, what are you doing? And anytime someone does that, that's a moment for us to come up and be like, we know what they're doing. Let's talk about Palestine. Let's talk about what AIPAC really does. Let's talk about what these groups really do, what they really are pushing for, and why common sense, good policy would be that we don't send a $3.8 billion blank check to an apartheid government. And so I think there's a lot to consider as we go into this next Congress, but I feel quite confident saying that this fight is only going to grow in Congress next year and it's not going to shrink. We're going to have more opportunities for more pieces of legislation, more escalated demands, and more opportunities for all of you as constituents to make your voice heard and get more involved. So I'll end on that note.
Next question. Can you each speak to how to effectively move organizations and/or politicians from a progressive accept Palestine stance to being active supporters of Palestinian rights? In other words, progressive on everything but Palestine is the question. How can you move politicians and organizations beyond that? Beth, you want to start with that?
I'll start with politicians. Then do you want to take organizations? Because I mean, I think that it's a different answer for those two pieces, right? I would give you a very different answer if you're talking about going to a group that you're a part of and you're a member of and you want it to be better on Palestine. That's an entirely different organizing game than trying to get your member of Congress to stop excluding Palestinian rights from the things that they care about. For politicians, this is going to be an annoying answer. It also depends. Everything depends. The first thing to do is look at the context that your politician is operating in. So I think that my pro tips for trying to advocate for someone who is progressive except for Palestine and is a member of Congress would be don't treat it with a big broad brush. It's not like not every single member of Congress is moved by the same things. Some members of Congress are genuinely moved by values-driven arguments and can have their minds changed on things. And if you can get grass tops people in your in their district to talk with them, and you can also pair that with showing that there's broad support for an issue, you can educate and move them. And there is also a reality, which is that more often than not, the way you get a politician to move and shift and change is by changing the environment around them, changing everything around them so that they have to readjust what their political calculus is. So there are some people who are progressive except for Palestine in an ideological way, and they just genuinely believe what they believe, and they may not move on this issue, or they may. But there are other people, and this is most people in Congress, who are progressive except for Palestine because they believe it is politically convenient for them to be progressive except for Palestine. They believe that that is what will get them elected, and that is what will keep them in office. And so it's our job as organizers to not just go to them and talk to them over and over again about the issues. It's our job to make it so that when they look around the next election cycle, they see that actually they're more likely to win if they have a better stance on Palestine than they did before. And so what that means is organizing the people around you, right? Having an organization, a group that you are organizing with, that is coming to them with with partner organizations, with coalition groups, with community leaders, with unexpected allies that they maybe didn't think were on your side, but are. And depending on who they are, you could do more escalated tactics too. Op-eds in the local paper that are calling them out for hypocrisy and lack of, consistency in how they treat different issues, or, petitions or protests at their office, depending on how bad they are. There's many different tactics you could use, but I think the most important thing anyone can do is take a beat and kind of assess okay, who is the organizing target here? And what moves them? Do they care what any particular community thinks more than another community? If so, we should go talk to that community and see if they're with us. And if so, let's go together to talk to them again, right? But a good tip, I think, is generally to say that it's not with every politician, the rule is you just email them constantly or call them constantly or protest them constantly. There are different political calculuses that any given politician is making, and it's our job as organizers to get really good at understanding them and researching that, and then changing the environment around them so that they now feel like they need to do what we want them to do. That's my not so short answer.
How is the new administration in Israel going to affect the Arab population?
Well, so these elections that happened in Israel last week, weren't a big surprise to Palestinians. I don't think it was a surprise to many Israelis either. I mean, this country has been shifting right for a long time. But that rightward swing really applies to their policies on lots of domestic issues, especially on the rights of gay and queer folks in the country. On the issue of Palestinians, the policy has always been no Palestinian is a good Palestinian. The goal of the state from the very beginning, whether it was a left-leaning coalition, a right-leaning coalition, a fascist coalition, I would call this coalition a fascist coalition, has always been the elimination of the Palestinian people, to make way for more Jewish people, for a Jewish majority to exist on a land that does not belong to them. You don't have a Jewish majority in the state of Israel unless you maintain a siege on Gaza. Gaza is 80% refugees. These are people that come from towns and villages that are just beyond the border barrier. They can go to the roofs of their homes and see their ancestral homes, see the homes of their grandparents. The reason that siege exists is to maintain this demographic majority that Israel insists on, right? Make sure that Jews are the majority. So, what is, the danger now is that we have an openly fascist government. What comes next really is, the possibility of, removal of not only, Palestinians that are in the West Bank, but potentially, what they've advocated for is even like the removal of Palestinians living in the area seized by Israel in 1948. So Palestinians in the Galilee, Palestinians in Haifa, Palestinians in Akka, all of us, are still seen as demographic threats and as targets of the state, whether they're citizens or not, whether they're under military occupation, under military siege, or citizens of the state. So I think we're going to be seeing more attacks on Palestinians that are citizens of the state, those that live in 1948 areas. And we're going to see escalated violence by settlers in the West Bank, because this Ben-Gavir and his party, that are now the third largest party in the Knesset, the ministry that Ben-Gavir wants is the police, the military police. And this will embolden not only the military in the West Bank, but it will embolden and give further impunity to settlers who are attacking Palestinians daily. So it is a very scary time.
I had a related question while you're talking about this issue. Is there any way advocates for the Palestinians can use the fact that this latest election was so right-wing, it represented in many ways everything that the Democrats were fighting against, were trying to get the vote out to protest this extreme right-wing proto-fascist political party? And can that be used this is probably not a good word, but to shame some of the people in Congress who were so adamantly in favor of saving our democracy, and yet when it comes to Israel, they don't notice, or they pretend not to notice what's happening? That's my question. Could we use any of this?
I'm happy to start on this one. I mean, I'll start by saying I don't have a problem with the naming and the shaming campaign. I'm fine with that. Yes, I think the short answer is yes. I think that what Sandra said is ultimately true, which is that, like, for those of us paying attention, this is not a surprising government. This is the inevitable government in this moment. But we're organizers, and our job isn't to be like, we knew this was always going to happen, why didn't you know? Like, our job is to be like, okay, you're upset now too. Great. Let's talk about it. Right? Like, that's what we all do. That's what Sandra does every day. That's what I'm doing. That's what you're all doing, is like taking these moments to like bring people in through these organizing opportunities. And so I think that, this is an opportunity. Right before the Israeli elections, there were actually some very stalwart pro-Israel members of Congress, like Senator Menendez, for example, who put out pretty strong statements about why someone like Itamar Ben-Gavir shouldn't be in a coalition government, and how disturbing and concerning that would be. I don't think he's said anything since the election results, unless I've missed it. So now his bluff has been called a little bit, and it's like, what's going to happen now that this person is in here? But I think it's a really good moment for us to say, like, okay, this is extreme. Like, this is a moment when something is being exposed about Israel And so we can all, more people will be willing to look at that under this government than they were before this government. And so I think that is an organizing opportunity for us. And it's an opportunity for us to say, like, do you really want to be dealing with these people? I'll just say one other note, which is that I think it's also a fascinating moment for us to think about the phrase that gets used over and over and over again by the Israeli government, by the US government, by, you know, anti-Palestinian groups. And that's that Israel and the US have shared values. That's the word, right? We have shared values. And in a moment like this, you just got to wonder what the values are. Like, they're not being named, but like, what are they? Because it doesn't seem like they're good values right now. So do we actually have shared values with this country that just elected and is building this coalition that is an apartheid state? Maybe we do. That might be a harsh reality we need to look at. But I think it's our job to say, like, we don't want to. We need to be better. And this is unacceptable. And they should not be our ally. And we need to break this and like sever this, because we don't actually have shared values. We should be different. We should be operating in a different way. So I do think it's an organizing opportunity.
We have to leave it there. But if you want Palestinians to have a happier new year, please get involved with a progressive group that is working to teach human rights to our president and Congress, so that there will be real change in U.S. policy concerning Palestine in 2023. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time, and on kkrn.org, where you can stream us live every Friday morning at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Time. If you miss a broadcast or want to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to our archive on the internet. Just type in truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and then click on archive. It is all there. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.